luck.
Yeah, but you know, as the Taoists believed in luck, the Buddha rejected all that. He insisted on cause and effect.
What kind of bike messenger are you? You still haven't answered my original question. Aren't you afraid of dying? I mean, the way you ride...
Now, you want to know what scares me is what happened to my friends who just got out of law school. That is collective insanity. Compared to that, going down Broadway at 50 with no brakes is fine.
Sounds good.
The bike wants to go fast. It's steadier that way. I've never been hurt going all out. It's just the hesitation that'll kill you.
So you're one of those guys. No brakes.
No, I hate brakes. Brakes and death.
Hello, and welcome to The Collision, Collider's podcast about movies, TV, and more. I'm the site's managing editor, Matt Goldberg, and with me today is Adam Chitwood.
Howdy.
Dave Trumbore isn't with us this week because he ran away to become a Ghostbuster. He left a note saying, and I quote, "Bustin' makes me feel good." So that's where he is now. This week we'll be talking about remakes, with the news that they plan to remake David Cronenberg's Videodrome with a script by Transformers 2 and 3 screenwriter Aaron Kruger and commercials director Adam Berg. We'll then move on to a completely unrelated discussion of Premium Rush. We couldn't really think of anything to tie in with Premium Rush in terms of a larger issue of, I don't know, bike movies. How long can you talk about bike movies, Adam?
Really not long.
Not long at all.
How many bike movies are there?
Not many.
I guess we could have run down all the extreme sports movies that have been made in history.
Oh, goody. I think we'll stick with remakes. And then, as always, we will finish up with our recommendations. So let's leap right into it. Remakes. We bemoan them constantly. And there's this... I'm trying to think how to put it. Seems to be a common complaint. They'll remake anything these days. And why do they always remake? Why aren't there any original ideas? An answer to the second question would be because then executives get to keep their jobs. Because if the remake fails, well, gosh, it was a brand name property. I can't be blamed. It was clearly succeeded the last time and has fans, so this must simply be a failure of the marketing or the directing or anything but me. I'm okay, as I don't greenlight any original ideas. It's a sad but true fact. Now, going to the first one, will they remake anything? And, Adam, what do you think?
Yes.
You think they...
Anything...
I'm sorry.
Essentially, nowadays, yes. It seems like, you know, back in the days... I mean, Brad Bird was on Twitter a couple days ago, basically kind of bemoaning the fact that, like, the top 10, the box office, like, top 10 of all time is just full of sequels and, you know, these based on previous material. There's no original material anymore. It didn't used to be risky to go off of an original idea, and how nowadays everything is, you know, prepackaged and everything. And I think goes back to what you're saying is, you know, executives don't want to lose their jobs. And so the easiest when you know, a bunch of executives are sitting around the room looking at the properties that they have and what they want to do, what they want to go forward, what directors they want to pursue to do projects, the easiest thing is to say, well, you know, for example, The Goonies is a movie that everyone loves. What if we did a new version of The Goonies that was edgy and gritty, which I'm sure is not too far away.
Well, that's the question. See, a Videodrome remake, I can see it. I don't want to see it. It's confusing. I like the original film a lot. I think it's a signature work of David Cronenberg. You shouldn't remake it. And also, it wasn't a hit when it came out. It's still, to this day, a cult movie. No one says, oh man, I've seen video. You haven't seen Videodrome? Lots of people haven't seen Videodrome. And it hasn't even permeated pop culture that much when you think about it. But it's a name that exists. But I was watching Back to the Future Part 2 the other night, actually last night, and still a fantastic film, by the way. Could you remake Back to the Future?
No. I mean, I'm not one of those people that is initially opposed to every I'm not going to bemoan every single remake that's announced. Like, for example, I thought a Total Recall remake would work because that's I mean, and this will probably get where we get further into the discussion, but if you take something that has a really good, like, idea, just a core idea, and you jump off that and make something completely different, which is not what Lynn Wiseman said or did, I think that is where a remake can work, when you're just, if you can take an idea like that, that you could, not just updating it to, like, the effects of today, but expanding upon something and making, like, an adaptation more than a remake.
Well, they're both adaptations. They're both adaptations of We Can Remember It For You Wholesale by Philip K. Dick, but go on.
Which is what everyone says whenever they remake a material, when they remake a movie that was based on a book, they always say, you know, we're going back to the book. And rarely, that's always the line that they always feed. You know, we're going back to the book, back to the source material. But to go to your point about Back to the Future, that's such a, I mean, not only is that series so specific to the 1980s, like everything in and around it, like all of the plot devices and everything works in the 80s. It would be a really, really, really tough thing to translate to, you know, like a different time period or to update. I don't even know how you would go about doing that.
Okay, can I pitch you another one?
Yeah, well, not to mention the fact that they're amazing movies.
Can you remake Indiana Jones?
I was thinking about this earlier. I think you can remake Indiana Jones. I think you can do a new version of Indiana Jones.
They wanted to reboot Indiana Jones. I know that. That's why Mutt Williams exists in Crystal Skull.
Well, because Indiana Jones exists more like the Indiana Jones series is like a series of pulp novels, you know, which is what Spielberg was going for in the beginning. So you could continue adventures with another Indiana Jones type character. Back to the Future, that trilogy is all about, you know, the arc of Doc and Marty and, you know, their lives and Jennifer. And that is one complete story told in three movies. It's not, you know, just a series like, oh, it's the new adventures of Marty and Doc. It all groups together with Robert Zemeckis' crazy ideas of using time travel to loop everything back together. But Indiana Jones, they are separate stories. They do have, you know, things that connect and characters that connect.
So you think a remake, but a continuation of the Indiana Jones. You don't think that, per se, someone comes in and says, I'm going to remake Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah. Well, and that's also, I know I'm probably in the minority when I say that. To me, when something is remade, it doesn't, in my mind, cheapen the earlier material. Like, that's always going to be there. Steven Spielberg's Raiders of the Lost Ark will always be there. And in my mind, like, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull doesn't tarnish Raiders of the Lost Ark for me. I mean, that's still an amazing movie, and that's still there, and I can go watch it anytime I want. So if they make a shitty remake, like Total Recall, Lynn Wiseman, 20 years from now, when people say Total Recall, they're going to think of Paul Verhoeven's version. They're not going to remember Lynn Wiseman's. It's not like his version just completely like, oh, Paul Verhoeven's version is ruined for me now.
Can you remake Star Wars?
That's another one that I think is so specific. That's a tough one. I think it will be remade. Not in the near future, but I think years and years and years from now, there will be a new Star Wars. What do you think? Do you think Star Wars can be remade?
I think anything can be remade, and that's the scary part. You see, anything. There's nothing, you know, untouchable. Why not? Someone comes along to Back to the Future. It's like, well, now we can do the 90s. And now we have all this great new technology so that when they go into the future in the inevitable sequel, then we can put even more technology and use what we know to extrapolate. So it'll be that kind of crazy future. And we'll play it this way, and we'll be sure to have a cameo by Christopher Lloyd and maybe Michael J. Fox popping up at some point, and we'll be sure to have references to the original movies, because that's what's called being faithful and loving. And you can remake anything. That's the whole point. And it's not a matter, I think, of tarnishing the original. Videodrome will still be there. No, they don't burn the print when they make a new one. No one goes into it. It's like, well, time to go to the National Preservation Society and light this on fire. It's still there, but the question is, why? Why would you, if the reason to remake something is you want the cover to say, well, this is a good idea and it has a name, well, why not just remake something that didn't succeed the first time but had a good idea? And I think that's a little harder to find. but we've seen it done. That's what Ocean's 11 is. The original Ocean's 11 is a terrible movie, just full of drunk, you know, rat packers hanging out together and getting paid to do it, and no one gives a shit. They turned that into a really fun, you know, heist film. That was, they updated it and got something better out of it. But what we're seeing is this film was a success the first time. And then that raises the question, well, then you can only go down. Why are you doing this to yourself? Why, if you need the cover?
They want the title. It's a built-in audience. I mean, it's a sure thing. Everyone's looking for the sure thing in the money business. And I don't know.
Right, but there is no sure thing with Videodrome. That's idiotic.
Well, that's why Videodrome is the exception. Videodrome doesn't make sense. This is like an incredibly puzzling decision because no one knows what Videodrome is. And they're remaking it in such a way that, if when they announce that there's a remake of Videodrome, the only people that know what Videodrome is will be vehemently opposed to a remake of Videodrome.
And should we be opposed? That's the other thing. Should we just write this off from the get-go? Can we not accept
when
the fact...
If the screenwriter, then you can be pessimistic about it.
Well,
I mean, you can't. I think it's unfair to write a movie off before a script exists or before there's a director, before it's hit theaters. I mean, we can be pessimistic about it. We can say we don't think it looks good, but we hope that it looks good.
Well, why not look on the bright side? I mean, I went and Slash Film posted a bunch of commercials by Adam Berg. The guy's got skills.
He does, and I can see by watching his commercials, I can see how the studio said, oh, this guy would be a good fit for Videodrome.
Depending on what they see Videodrome to be. I think when we, just as a brief aside, when people are like, oh, it's the next Spike Jonze, it's the next Michel Gondry, let's remember that those guys, when they did their first film, they didn't get to do a blockbuster. They didn't get to do a tentpole movie. Spike Jonze started on a film on Being John Malkovich, which is a film nobody wanted to make. It had a reputation for the best screenplay no one would make.
Who greenlights that?
Who greens like that? But thank goodness someone did. I mean, I think it was an indie feature, so that's not really a greenlight thing. That was really more of who chose to distribute it. And gosh, see, now I've lost my train of thought. Thanks, Being John Malkovich. No, back to blockbusters. We've seen this problem crop up with 47 Ronin. Yeah, this might be a cautionary tale. And we saw Carl Eric Rinch's, we saw his commercials, and they were really good. We saw his short films, and they were really good. And 47 Ronin has spiraled out of control in a big way. And who's to say that Adam Berg won't suffer the same fate? Just because he is has a visual style, there's another reason they bring these guys in, and that's because they have no clout. That's because they don't rock the boat. They're supposed to bring their ideas and their visuals, but they're not supposed to challenge anyone. They're supposed to make it look cool, but not aggressive. Don't do anything offensive. And that
they're supposed to take every studio note that's given to them to a T.
Pretty much. And Aaron Kruger sure knows how to do that. Boy,
well,
he'll just write anything that you tell him.
Well, that reminds me of Ruben Fleischer, who directed Zombieland. Coming off of Zombieland was a huge success, and that was his feature directorial debut. I believe he did commercials before that, and he was offered a lot of big movies after that, and he said, no, I want to do another smaller movie because that scares me. Like, I don't want to be the guy that, you know, goes straight from Zombieland to this big movie and completely fumbles it. So he did 30 minutes or less and then decided to go big with Gangster Squad. So I think that, you know, that's a smart way of looking at it. Is it a good idea to give these commercial directors these giant, giant movies with so much studio control?
And we should say up front, just to be clear, we don't know if Videodrome is going to be a big budget film. Although it seems, if we can quote what they said, it was something along the lines of a action thriller. I want to quote this just to make sure I got it. They plan to modernize the concept, infusing it with the possibilities of nanotechnology and blow it up into a large-scale sci-fi action thriller, which does indicate a blockbuster tentpole.
Yeah.
And it when you read that, it's like, did you even see Videodrome? Did you see it? Did you take anything away from it beyond, wow, that dude's hand got really fucked up and it has absorbed that gun. Nanotechnology! Oh, they're going to update the concept. Videodrome is incredibly relevant, disturbingly so. If you go and watch it, you'll be like, holy shit, that is prescient. Wow.
And too.
I'm sorry?
And surreal, too, which is not easier, which is not easy for, you know, general audiences to swallow.
But I got upset about it, and that's the thing. Is it worth getting upset? I feel guilty almost at this point. I'm upset even though the original exists, and there is always the possibility, however far-fetched, that it may be a good movie. Am I wrong to feel bad about already being against this remake?
Well, I think a better reason to feel bad about it is that it's taking up one more slot in, you know, like a studio's slate that could be taken by an original idea, an original story, a really like interesting new story. Like, you know, I mean, I've already picked out my recommendation for this week, and it's Rian Johnson's Brick, like something like that. We see Looper that's coming out. Why can't we have more movies like that? And it's just kind of disheartening to see every studio filling their slate with, you know, based on the book by a remake.
Adaptations, remakes, sequels.
Sequel too. Yeah.
And we're going to go back, and we are going to try to find time for this. We're probably going to have to do it on Sunday. I don't see how we can't. We're going to dissect Summer 2012. And what a clusterfuck of terrible movies that is just... since we're talking about it, shit, let's just pull it up right now. Let's go back through this summer and see what we had, okay? And obviously Box Office Mojo isn't going to help me with what we've seen. Let's just go dive in to this summer. We've got Bourne Legacy. I'm going by the box office stuff so far. We have got Bourne Legacy, which is a reboot / sequel.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, let's look at the top 10, all right? Avengers, super crossover, great, you know, really good movie. Let's not say just because it's a remake or reboot that makes it bad. But we're just going through the biggest films of the year. What are they? Avengers, sequel, crossover, huge. Dark Knight Rises, sequel. Hunger Games, adaptation. Amazing Spider-Man, reboot. Brave, original idea. Ted, original idea. Lorax, adaptation. Madagascar, sequel. Men in Black 3, sequel. Snow White and the Huntsman, adaptation. Do you want to go adaptation? Nah, let's say adaptation.
Loose adaptation.
Loose adaptation.
Yeah. It's a known property. Yeah. It's the same thinking.
Yeah. Ice Age, Continental Drift, sequel. 21 Jump Street, adaptation. Prometheus, prequel. Safe House, original idea. No, I'm sorry. No, yeah, it is. I'm sorry. I thought for a second it was a remake of a foreign film. It's not. The Vow. Is that adapted from a Nicholas Sparks book?
No, it's adapted from a nonfiction, like a faith-based book.
Okay, then. Magic Mike, original idea. Journey to the Mysterious Island, sequel. Think Like a Man, original idea, I believe. Or is that adapted from
Steve Harvey book?
So adaptation. And Bourne Legacy, and then Wrath of the Titans, sequel. Those are your top 20 highest-grossing films of 2012. And I don't know how many I would say are good, but that's the game here, people. That is pushing marketing, and let's also go with some flops. John Carter is an adaptation, 100 years in the making. And I don't think it's a bad film, but it's this complicated cross-section of what are we looking for from a remake. If from a business perspective, it's a sound business perspective, actually, if you're the studio executive.
Mm-hmm.
If you're the consumer, it gets a little dicier. But as we just saw, read off the top 20, people are going to see those movies. So the brand name recognition isn't just for cover for the studio. It's enticing for the audience. Do people want something they can understand? They're like, well, I liked that, so I like this. I liked the first two movies. I'll like that. It seems that the property and the actor are the two highest considerations for anything. And actually, the brand is more important.
We don't even have that many movie stars left. You know, back in the 90s and early 2000s, you could bank on Will Smith. You could bank on
absolutely.
Tom Cruise.
Absolutely.
Like, Will Smith is one of the like only movie stars left in the world. You cannot bank on anyone these days. So they're having to surround them by, you know, you can't just take an original, like a really cool, if like Tom Cruise decides to get behind a really cool original idea, that movie is not automatically greenlighted. If he gets behind, you know, Guillermo del Toro's At the Mountains of Madness with James Cameron producing, Universal still says no.
They're like, no, we're going to make Battleship. That's a moneymaker. Don't you tell us. And you know what's funny? There would be cover for that because it's a horror novel and it's considered a classic. Whereas Battleship is a fucking board game and people look at that and they're like, that's fucking stupid. What do you say to most people who it's like At the Mountains of Madness? And they're like, okay, I don't know anything about that. It's a book. Okay, books are credible. Books are more credible than a board game. Let's put it that way. And not to say that a movie based off a board game would be inherently bad. It's just when you hear that, it's a tougher sell, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and I think studios assumed that audiences would buy into Battleship because, you know, oh, it's like Transformers. It's got robots and stuff, and you know, they'll be fine. But they underestimated the audiences saying that's based on a board game, that's fucking stupid.
And also none of the trailers looked good or anything like that.
Battleship was, I don't think it was that terrible of a movie.
I do. I think it was pretty bad. After talking to the effects guys at ILM, I appreciate the effects more. Let's put it that way. It wasn't completely irredeemable. But
we also had, you know, the smashing success of Ted this summer, Seth MacFarlane's, which, I mean, you could argue that that's the built-in audience of Family Guy, but you can guarantee we're going to see some.
But that's just in the making. You know, that's one of the things. We shouldn't begrudge someone for succeeding. That's the other thing.
No. Well, and I'm just saying that this summer wasn't devoid of, you know, good. I thought Ted was a good movie. Magic Mike is one of my favorite movies.
Oh, no, I'm just talking about the films that get that have a – if you're gonna if a studio is gonna pay a lot of money for a movie, they can't be an original idea. Inception is the exception to the rule,
and that's only because Christopher Nolan had just done The Dark Knight,
and he got Leonardo DiCaprio to star.
Yeah,
and that's an insane, and then backed him up with other really talented actors. But that's and look at that confluence of events for that one daring idea. Who else gets to do that? Not really anybody. I mean, even Spielberg. I mean,
Spielberg's having trouble.
He's having trouble these days. That's insane that Steven Spielberg, of all people, should have trouble. And he's adapting stuff, which is, again, not necessarily bad. Maybe Robopocalypse is a great book. I haven't read it. But I don't know. It's so tough to say where do these original movies, and are we missing anything? That's the other half of it. Just because something's original, that doesn't automatically make it good. Or does that at the very least, further it? That might inspire something? Is being original inherently good?
I don't think so, and I think you can attest to that because you've been to the Sundance Film Festival, 2 years now? Did you go 2 years?
2 years.
We're seeing that original ideas are being forced to, you know, go the not exactly micro budget, but really small budget. We're not seeing studios pay for those mid-level, you know, $50, $60 million dramas unless Ben Affleck's directing them. There are their fair share of bad original ideas, but is it a terrible thing that they're having to linger in the independent system? Because that gives them more, you know, we get to see movies like Martha Marcy, May Marlene, which is, you know, just mind-blowing. Shame, Steve McQueen and Michael Fassbender, movies like that, you know, you don't need a lot of money to get behind those movies.
Sure.
So do you think that original ideas are going to be pushed down to, you know, they're just going to live in that $10, $20 million dramas now?
It looks that way. I think that the original ideas are going to be constrained to the lower budget films. You can't pump. There will be no room for an expensive original idea. and the only upside is that technology gets cheaper. Eventually, we've seen short films where they're using really cool effects, and
Chronicle was a low budget. I mean, relatively low budget original idea that did really, really well, and the effects in that were great.
Exactly. So these budgets will come down. And also, let's be fair. When we talk about a big budget film, there is wasteful spending on blockbusters. There just is. And you can just ask Robert Rodriguez. That dude makes everything in-house. And I'm not saying his movies are good, but they look more expensive than they are. I mean, their budget. He knows how to stretch a budget, and he had to when he made El Mariachi. He wrote a book about it, and I think that when we talk about, you know, a big budget and the original idea, it's just, again, this whole conversation comes back to, for me, why did I get so angry? Why does anyone get angry about this? Shouldn't we be angry at someone remaking RoboCop? I mean, was that a bad idea?
I mean, that, again, from my perspective, wait and see. RoboCop is not an untouchable property to me, and I think as we're seeing, anything that can be remade will be remade. Even though, you know, Drew McQueenie gave the RoboCop script a pretty good lashing on Twitter.
Yes, he did. But I mean, can anything have a sequel? Anything can have a reboot? I think so. I think one day down the line, going back to Back to the Future, Marty, it's your kids. Your kids built the time machine, Marty. They found my plans. And now we have to go 89 miles per hour. I don't know.
Well, and that's the thing, because remakes are – they're kind of a – it's this new business model. This didn't happen in the 70s. It wasn't like – the remakes existed, but it wasn't like, you know, remake everything, sequelize everything.
No, it was that more adaptations.
Yeah, that didn't happen.
No,
and so that's kind of like it remains to be seen if it will burn out as a, you know, fad or phenomenon.
Well, how can we ever go forward? That's the other question. How can we go forward? Eventually, what will be left to remake? You'll remake the remakes.
We'll have a remake 5 years after another movie comes out, which is what they're doing, and then they call it rebooting.
Exactly. Yeah, we didn't quite get it right the first time. Give us another shot, and we'll get it right this time. Although, we're still at the, I would call the reboot a second adaptation, to be fair, because, look at it this way, I'm thinking, like, Ghost Rider. So the first Ghost Rider, kind of a success. Actually, Punisher's a better example. Punisher, not really much of a success, so that's the first adaptation. And then they do a new adaptation, which I think is a second swing at the pitch. Which I think is not necessarily a bad idea. I think a bad idea would be, let's reboot Total Recall again. Yeah. We are going to get this right, damn it. Get Sean Levy on the phone.
Yeah, I mean, The Amazing Spider-Man was not a bad idea in and of itself. The studio needed to keep the rights to Spider-Man. They needed to make another Spider-Man movie. So, you know, you have to reboot it. Sam Raimi and Tobey Maguire, they had all run their course. They didn't see eye to eye on Spider-Man 4, so they parted ways, and it's time to reboot. That, I don't think that in and of itself was a bad idea, to reboot Spider-Man.
I'm wondering where this is all going to be 20 years from now, because I'm looking at the big shifts. I look at the big picture. Haha, look at me. I just realized I look at the big shifts, and like just how fucking pretentious that sounded.
I mean, Matt Goldberg is better than everyone.
Well, yeah, obviously, but fuck. What I was gonna say is it's not just what's being made is being changed. It's the venues. People aren't going to the movie theater anymore, and 3D is supposed to lure them back. Except, in their infinite wisdom, they're making more 3D TVs, which will in turn make sure there's no reason for you to go back to the theater. I think movie theaters are a dying breed. I really do.
And that's what 48 frames per second is supposed to get people back to the
theaters. Yeah, and it won't. I don't care.
Maybe that's why studios are less willing to gamble on an original idea, because people aren't going to the movies anymore, and you know, you want the safest.
But you're still spending the money. At the end of the day, you're still spending the money. You're going to throw $100 million at something, and they're not going to come to see it either way. At least throw $100 million on something that, to play to your interests, that you can have in your catalog to reboot 10 years from now. Look at The Long Game. No, I'm serious, because at least when you reboot it for TV screens, because that's what you're going to be rebooting it to. In 20 years, there will not be movie theaters like there are now. There will not be 4,000 screens to release a movie to. People will stay home because it's easier that way, because it costs the same. Because, and this is what, again, side note, why do people get so bitchy about the price of popcorn and soda? I mean, that's where the theater makes their money, but no one forces you to buy that shit.
That's true.
It's like, soda and the popcorn's so damn expensive. I'm like, you can bitch about the ticket price, but no one's asking you to buy a bucket of fucking popcorn. If you're that desperate, you can smuggle in snacks. They don't pat people down, at least not yet anyway. But
well, yeah, with the 3D upcharge, like a family of four is paying like $100 to go see a movie, whereas if you buy VOD at home, you're paying one, like the price of essentially one ticket. I think now the standard is $6.99.
And the release date, and the release date is the release window is closing every day. You can just, it takes about 3 to 4 months to get the movie into homes.
Battleship is coming out on Blu-ray this Tuesday, and it opened in
May 14th.
May 14th, yeah.
Right. And was Battleship in 3D? I don't think so.
No, it wasn't. Okay.
Let's say it had been in 3D, and you had a 3D TV, and you didn't think the movie looked that good, but the family was like, okay, not really. So, like you said, that's $100 right there. Family of five, $20 a ticket, IMAX, whatever. Family doesn't care. They don't want to go to IMAX. They're not that excited about the film, but they want to see it. So what do? Well, rental places are getting harder to find. VOD is getting harder. Can you VOD a film in 3D?
If you have a 3D television screen, I think they've started rolling out VOD 3D.
My point is, you can get the movie for the whole family, a movie for five for the price of one, and just stay in your living room. And the only thing you'll have to trade is, I don't get to see Battleship when it comes out and be part of the conversation. I mean,
which is so depressing, because movie theaters are like a magical place. Like, I watched Side by Side last week, and you see this kid watching Lawrence of Arabia on his iPhone, and you just want to punch him in the face. I mean,
I feel bad watching Lawrence of Arabia on a TV. I won't do it. It's coming to theaters in October, and I'm like, I must go to that. I'm bummed I'm not going to get to see Indiana Jones on IMAX.
People have just forgotten that. You know, they like you said, like, this goes back to, I think this was our first podcast, how movie theaters are, people are starting to treat movie theaters like their living room. And then, you know, essentially that means they want to be in their living room. They want to be texting. They want to be multitasking. They want to be on their iPad while they're half watching this movie.
Right. And so stay at home and they'll figure that out. They're like, wait. I have to get in my car, drive somewhere, find parking, go to the booth and buy an expensive ticket for a movie, and some people might get on my case about texting, and popcorn is so expensive. You know what? If popcorn is that fucking big a deal to you, stay home, buy a $3 bag, pop it yourself. You're done. Buy a soda from the machine for $1.50. You're done. But seriously, if those are the amenities that you fucking cherish when you go see a movie, just stay at home, and they will stay at home. And it doesn't matter what you remake. It doesn't matter that you're going to remake Videodrome. No one's going to come to see it. Let's talk about Premium Rush, unless you have something else to say about remakes.
No, it's just depressing. It's just a depressing thought to think that movie theaters are going away.
It is. It is a very depressing thought. But bike messengers always make the day a little brighter. We wish we had something better. I wish they had released Sleepwalk With Me in wider release. It did really well in one theater. It pulled in 65,000 this weekend, which is the third highest grossing indie release of the year behind Moonrise Kingdom and To Rome with Love. And keep in mind that Sleepwalk with Me doesn't have any major movie stars. So right on to that film. I can't wait to see it again. I saw it at South by Southwest. Premium Rush does have Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and he plays a bike messenger named Wiley. And do you want me to do the synopsis of Premium Rush? He gets an envelope, and a corrupt cop plays by Michael Shannon wants the envelope, and Wiley has to race around the city while Michael Shannon is trying to chase him on his bike because this package has something really important. And for Michael Shannon, who's like a gambling addict, and if he gets the package from Joseph Gordon-Levitt, then he can pay off his debt. But Joseph Gordon-Levitt's the best bike messenger in the world, and he doesn't care, man. His bike doesn't have brakes because he has a death wish, and he's not going to live in an office, man. He's not going to be constrained to a desk. He's going to get paid shit, and that's okay because riding a bike in New York is the way to feel alive. And that's the best I know about Wiley, because David Koepp, who co-wrote and then directed the film, he gives you no character development in this movie. Everything about Wiley is basically told to you. Joseph Gordon-Levitt plays the character kind of aloof. And that's about it. There's no character arc there. There's no relationship that really has any meaning. He has a girlfriend. He doesn't go to her graduation, so she's pissed at him. But their love will be rekindled by Michael Shannon trying to kill him. I don't know what to say. Adam, jump in here, please.
You know what? I like this movie. I thought it was a lot of fun.
Oh, God!
I like Premium Rush. It's one of those movies that it knows exactly what it is. It's not
what
trying
is
to be
it?
High.
But what is it trying to be?
I think it's just supposed to be like a fun popcorn movie. I think
popcorn is expensive, Adam!
Oh, fuck you.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but it is expensive. Go.
I think the point where the movie falters in my eyes is when it tries to get too serious, where the subplot, you know, tries to deal with these kind of heady issues of, you know, human trafficking. But it's a lot of fun, man. I mean, and I was really dreading going to see this movie. I wasn't, you know, I was like, oh God. Like, I love Joseph Gordon-Levitt, but I underestimated the power of his charisma. Because, you know, he's just charming as all get up to watching this movie. You know, it's fun, you know, following around. I thought the bike scenes were going to get really tedious and boring, and they did not. I just kind of found it really fun how Kep found a way to visualize him, you know, racing across the city. If you're unaware, the movie kind of takes place sort of in real time. It takes place over the span of like an hour and a half. But
it keeps jumping back and forth. Flashbacks. Yeah.
Yeah, it plays with the narrative a little bit. There were a couple kind of like sight visual gags that I felt like David Koepp thought were cooler and smarter than they
actually
were.
Were you talking about Wiley Vision?
Yeah, in actuality, which I thought that was kind of stupid. But it's a silly movie. It's about a bike messenger. You're never, you know, and as in most action movies and stuff, you know, you're like, oh, that's the stunt guy. I thought it was going to be kind of, you know, that doesn't look like Joseph Gordon-Levitt or, you know, what's going on here. But I really, really liked the way Kep filmed this kind of like bike racing across town. And worth the price of admission is to watch Michael Shannon just chew the scenery up like no other. I mean, he is hamming it up as the villain in this movie. This movie would not be near as entertaining without him in it. I think he's a big reason why it works, because he's just so demented and weak, but not like a, you know, it's not like he's a villain with mental problems or he's got some crazy backstory. He's just a goofy guy. And I felt there's one role in the movie, Jamie Chung plays this Asian girl, and she's an American actress, and I thought it kind of borderlined on racism, the accent that she used. It kind of made me a little uncomfortable, the way she was kind of playing up the Asian role. I don't know if that bothered anyone else, but
I actually didn't know that she was. Actually, now that you mention it, it kind of does bother. I forgot that it was Jamie Chung, and then I just didn't think about it. But you're right. That's sort of like you know, asking the black actor to be, and it's like, yes, Massa, I'll get the, you know, it's yeah, a little heavy. It is. It's a little, this does take place in 2012, doesn't it? Or,
yeah,
I don't know. You mentioned a lot of things I do like. I think Michael Shannon's great. I think it's photographed really well. And a lot of the time I was wondering, holy, how did they shoot that? How did they get that bike to swerve that way? Those stunts are really impressive.
Yeah.
And it is playful. It's playful with its cinematography. He finds interesting way to try to keep conversations going. But to me, those are tricks. They don't make the film necessarily better. They're sort of ways to keep it peppy, but they don't make the story any better. They just keep the momentum going. But I think story matters, and I think this is a very weak story. And the other thing that I find confusing about it is I think Kep sees this society of bike messengers as sort of a playful, impish kind of mischief makers of the city. They'll weave in, you know, they're causing trouble and they're misunderstood and they'll run from the cops because they don't care. But the way they're shown, the way they're written is kind of rebellious dicks. They're sort of the outcasts of society. They're not just little mischief makers. They're the guys who will get in your face, that can be called upon and organized. That's the other thing. They are a force, a almost militant force when they want to be. So this notion of,
they become like a street gang.
Exactly. So if they're a street gang, when you have this sort of street gang thing, it's weird to go into, like, Wily Vision, which, for those who haven't seen the film, it's kind of like Spider-Sense, where everything slows down, and then Joseph Gordon-Levitt, in a split second, can see all these fun little routes that would kill him, and then he sees the correct one and goes that way. And it's entertaining, and it's cute, and I liked it, but it doesn't seem to fit with the society he lives in, and with the crime story. And like you mentioned, it's like this has something to do with human trafficking, and yet you have Michael Shannon chewing the scenery, and it's a weird mishmash. And I could almost handle it if I thought there was more to the characters or the story. I think just because it's light, that doesn't mean it needs to be empty.
See, I don't know. I felt it was compelling. I loved the way that Kep dealt with dialogue, because you have these people are on bikes running separate tracks throughout this whole thing, and the way he used cell phones and kind of the chemistry between Joseph Gordon-Levitt and her, I don't know how you pronounce her name, I think it's Dania Ramirez, yeah. I thought was really, really great, and I was kind of surprised by that too, because I wasn't hugely impressed by her and kind of her previous work, but I thought it kind of came across well. I mean, I wasn't super bothered by, I wasn't looking for like a lot of like deep story or deep character development. I kind of saw it as, you know, kind of these two people were having a tiff, kind of more of like an episode of TV, maybe a sitcom or like an hour episode of television.
She's kind of missing him, and he hasn't really changed, yeah. But yeah, he hasn't changed in any significant way, but they're going to get back together. I bet.
Yeah,
I wonder how things will be in Premium Rush too. Ha ha ha! That's not movies. Never gonna happen. Ha! But yeah, I don't know. It's to me, I don't care about the relationship because it's so perfunctory. It's like, well, he needs a love interest. He's got to have a love interest, and she's got to be mad at him, and he's gonna show her he's really changed, except without changing. It's more like she can't live without him because he's the world's best bike messenger. The world would be a lesser place without Wily.
Yeah, I wasn't emotionally invested in these stories at all, but that's a testament to Joseph Gordon-Levitt and, you know, just his ability to, his charisma to leap off the screen so that you're rooting for him, even though you really don't have like a vested interest in what he's doing. And at the end of the day, the envelope is a MacGuffin. It could be anything.
Oh, no, I don't, yeah, the envelope is whatever. It's just the weird backstory they put behind the envelope.
Yeah.
Like, what is
which was my major qualm, that I felt like it just got kind of heavy and was just kind of too heavy for a movie that was like
that was about flighty bike messengers and Michael Shannon just taking every piece of scenery he could find and just masticating it like hell.
Oh God, he's so great.
He is. He's so much fun. So, do you want to move on to recommendations?
Sure.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off on Premium Rush. I felt like it just started to feel like we were going in circles about We were, wait for it, people. Wait for it. Wait for it. Spinning our wheels! Boom! Let's go on to recommendation. I love puns.
Boom.
why don't you start with recommendations?
Okay, since Looper is, coming out really, really soon, and Joseph Gordon-Levitt was in Premium Rush, I'm going to recommend Brick. Chances are you've probably heard of it, but I really think that everyone should absolutely see this movie, especially before you see Looper, just to kind of get an idea. It's a 2005 film written and directed by Rian Johnson. If you don't know, he also wrote and directed. Brick was his feature directorial debut, and he also wrote and directed The Brothers Bloom after that, and Looper will be his third film, a sci-fi movie. And Brick is one of those movies that my roommate in college was like, man, you got to see this. And I was like, what is it? I've never heard of it. And I was kind of, I like to pride myself in that I knew quite a bit about movies, and I hadn't heard of it, so I was like, it must not be very good. He described it to me as a film noir set in high schools during Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and I was like, I'm in. And it's really just this brilliantly original kind of hard-boiled detective story that takes place in high school in a California suburb. Joseph Gordon-Levitt is the star. He's a high school student. He's kind of living lonely after breaking up with his girlfriend, and he receives a phone call from her in the beginning of the movie, and she mentions three key words that he uses to kind of solve the mystery. She disappears after the phone call, and he's trying to, kind of figure out what's going on, and it really kind of, it takes a lot from film noir. It's very, very reminiscent of Out of the Past, if you've ever seen that movie.
I actually saw that for the first time yesterday. It's really, really good.
It's fantastic.
Not Brick, but Brick out of the past. I've seen Brick.
Yes. Well, they're both fantastic.
Yes, they are. Continue.
Brick, it's a lot of fun. And what's most exciting about it is you've never seen this story before. It's brilliantly original. Rian Johnson is just a genius of originality and just bringing you into a story that is something you've never seen before, which is, as we talked about earlier, is very, very rare. So it's available on Watch Instantly on Netflix now, so you should most definitely watch it before Looper comes out and blows your mind. I think that comes out in September, I believe, but it looks amazing. And The Brothers Bloom as well.
Oh, I love The Brothers Bloom to death. Do a double feature, people. Rian Johnson, all the time. Okay, I will finish up. I'll go back to biking. Cycling. There's a different, but it reminds me of the joke in Super Troopers where he's like, biker, I'm an idiot. I'm going to recommend the film, 1979 film Breaking Away, which is just a really great coming of age film. And it stars Dennis Christopher, Dennis Quaid, Daniel Stern, and Jackie Earle Haley as these four friends living in Indiana, and they live sort of in the poorer part of their town. And Dave, the character played by Dennis Christopher, he just falls in love with bicycle racing, especially Italian cycling, and he sort of falls in love with that culture. And it's fascinating because, he's trying to escape from sort of his working class life, even though he has friends there and he's not ashamed of it. But his father, is a former stone cutter and he can be a little sleazy. And so he doesn't really, his father doesn't really understand him, and Dave's trying not to be himself, but he does have a genuine love of cycling. And it's one of those movies, just really inspirational and I don't want to say inspirational. That's not the right word. It's just uplifting. It's uplifting in a really sweet way, and just kind of, and in an unexpected way. It's the coming of age film mixed with kind of a sports movie, and it's like, but not in kind of like a Sandlot way. Sandlot is very much like, this is playing to kids. Breaking Away never feels that way. Breaking Away feels very mature in how it is, and I just really enjoy it. And it's not like people are having phone calls on their I would love that, though, if that in 1979 they somehow found a way for people on bicycles to have phone conversations.
This giant phone with really
exactly,
long
and they're not holding on to the handles because they're trying to hold their phone with two hands. But it's,
they got the rotary dial.
Yeah, it's a really sweet movie, and I highly recommend checking out Breaking Away. So that's it for this week. Hopefully we'll have Dave back with us next week. You can follow this podcast on Twitter. Let me back up. Theoretically, you can follow this podcast on Twitter. I've been bad about updating our Twitter feed and having two separate Twitter feeds for the collision. So from now on, just explaining, just follow me on Twitter. Follow all of us. Like, you guys will retweet the podcast, right?
Yeah,
so just follow any of us on Twitter. You can follow me on Twitter at Matt Goldberg. Adam, where can we find you on Twitter?
At Adam Chitwood.
And you can find Dave on Twitter at GhostbusterFan.345. No, you can find him at DrClawMD. We will be back next week talking about summer 2012 and trying not to retread what we talked about here, but it will be a fun conversation. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back with you next week.